Hello, everyone. I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to the PCJ International Newsroom. This is Focus Asia Pacific. The United Nations is preparing to publish a new report examining the atrocities that took place at the end of Sri Lanka's civil war in 2009. The man who was running the country at the time, Mahinda Rajapaksa, has lost power, but a number of ministry military figures involved remain. Peter Lloyd reports.
It's a war that's never been fully accounted for. After a quarter of a century, the fight between government forces and the breakaway Tamil Tigers ended in spectacular violence in early 2009. As many as 40,000 people were killed in the final weeks of the war. Almost no Tamil Tiger leader survived, leaving few to be held responsible for the wartime atrocities. On the other side, it is a different story. There are army commanders and politicians still alive and still wielding influence, according to Sisira Jayasuriya, professor of economics at Monash University.
Many of the top people who are still in high positions, including people who have been promoted recently, have been implicated, at least there have been allegations made.
But when the UN issues its report, all eyes will be on Mahinda Rajapaksa, the president who ended the war. A year ago, Rajapaksa was riding high after a decade in power. But a decision to call a presidential election in November, 2 years early, backfired. Mahinda Rajapaksa lost. Chandra Attukarala is a professor of economics from the Crawford School at the ANU. He reckons savvy voters in Sri Lanka were simply fed up.
This election is unique in Sri Lankan political history simply because corruption and nepotism were the key issues which created this massive election backlash. Sri Lankan electorate is very vigilant. I mean, as you know, the literacy rate is about 95% in our country, right? They really don't tolerate corruption and nepotism.
Last week, the veteran politician suffered another humiliation. Parliamentary elections saw his party fail to win a majority, ending a bid to become prime minister. Though he's lost influence, there seems little appetite among Sri Lanka's new government for an international and transparent war crimes investigation. For one thing, the military brass wouldn't take kindly to it. Sisira Jayasuriya from Monash University again.
This is going to be interesting how this will play out.
How delicate is the relationship between the government, the new government, and the military?
I don't think that there's any major tensions, but there would be tensions if the government aggressively moves to, say, implement any serious investigations into what happened during the war.
Sri Lanka's new government has already had to reckon with another Rajapaksa legacy. The post-civil war boom in massive debt-financed public spending has turned into a bust. The ANU's Chandra Attukarala.
Most of this investment went to long-term projects without studying the viability or payoff from these projects. The new government, the biggest challenge is to tackle the foreign debt problem.
How much does Sri Lanka owe the international community?
They have borrowed more than $3 billion from China alone.
The cozy ties between Beijing and Colombo have now been loosened since the end of the Rajapaksa regime. Sri Lanka's new government wants to rebuild its relationship with the West. Its first big test looms with the response to the United Nations report into how the civil war was won.
That was Peter Lloyd reporting. In Australia, Federal Parliament's Treaties Committee has recommended Australia should hold off selling uranium to India until safeguards are in place. The Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, signed the deal with India's leader, Narendra Modi, last year, even though India has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Political correspondent Louise Yaxley has the story.
The agreement is for Australia and India to cooperate on the peaceful use of nuclear energy. It means Australia could sell uranium to India, and the Treaties Committee Chairman, Liberal Wyatt Roy, says that could mean a doubling in the size of the Australian uranium industry. He says it could also mean a more reliable electricity supply for Indians, but Mr. Roy says it comes with risks.
The committee notes some concerns about flaws in India's nuclear regulatory arrangements, identified by the Indian Auditor General and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Recognising this, the committee recommends that no Australian nuclear fuel be sold to India until they are addressed.
Mr. Roy says experts disagree about whether the agreement would breach the South Pacific Nuclear Weapons Free Zone Treaty, known as the Treaty of Rarotonga.
Experienced legal practitioners who have participated in the inquiry appear to have differing interpretations of a couple of aspects of the agreement, leaving the committee unable to determine which interpretation was correct. The committee has recommended in each case that the Australian government outline the legal advice that it has received.
The committee's called for five safeguards before uranium could be sold to India, as the committee's deputy chairman, Labor's Kelvin Thompson, spelled out in Parliament.
We've recommended that uranium sales to India only commence when, one, India has achieved the full separation of civil and military nuclear facilities as verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency, two, India has established an independent nuclear regulatory authority under law, three, the Indian nuclear regulator's existing policies and arrangements have been reviewed to ensure its independence, four, the frequency, quality and comprehensiveness of on-site inspections at nuclear facilities have been verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency as being of best practice standard, and five, the lack of sufficient planning for the decommissioning of nuclear facilities has been rectified.
It is a bipartisan report dominated by coalition MPs, as Greens Senator Scott Ludlam noted.
The Greens' additional comments, not a dissent, but additional comments, acknowledge the warnings that the majority government-chaired report have put into the public domain today. This is absolutely not a green light for Australian yellow cake to be sold to India. India is not a signatory to global non-proliferation and disarmament law. It is arguably unlawful against the articles of the Treaty of Rarotonga for Australia to engage in this trade to a non-signatory. And we heard, or the Treaties Committee heard, I should say, hair-raising evidence to the fact that the Indian regulatory environment is simply not sufficient and not up to the task of keeping track of Australian obligated uranium.
The Australian Conservation Foundation's Dave Sweeney emphasises the warnings in the committee's report.
This report is saying that uranium sales to India are fully on the back burner. That is clearly what this report is saying. If the government takes it seriously and if the government steps up to its responsibilities to govern in the national interest, not in the sectional interest of the underperforming uranium sector, then what this committee has said, the checks and balances that need to be put in place, the deficiencies that need to be addressed, the security and safety issues that need to be answered, they are profound. It is putting this issue front and centre, saying it is unsafe, unproven, and there can be no justification for the government going ahead at this time.
In a statement, the Foreign Minister Julie Bishop says the committee's conducted a rigorous review of the nuclear agreement with India, which reflects the importance that the government and parliament place on effective safeguards. She says the ratification of the agreement's a priority for the government and it will examine the committee's findings and respond in due course. So while Ms. Bishop highlights the government's determination to ratify this agreement, she hasn't responded to the committee's call for no uranium to actually be sold until the long list of safeguards is in place.
Last week, Beijing had a massive military parade, and it staged, for the first time, new military equipment that China is using. Some of it actually had not been seen by the world. It was one of those celebrations that reminded people of old times when Mao Zedong was the leader of China. Our correspondent Stephen MacDonald was watching the parade firsthand and actually started to think, what would happen if something like this was held in another country? Let's say Canada, the United States, or even Australia. Here's Stephen MacDonald.
Before I start, from the outset, I should point out that all the Chinese people I spoke to thought last week's humongous military parade was pretty amazing. Something, in fact, to be proud of. And why wouldn't they? What a spectacle it was to behold. They were jealous that I, as a journalist, had the privilege to watch it from Tiananmen Square. Yet as a hypothetical scenario, let's assume the Australian government was watching China's Yuebing and thought, you know, we could turn on a military spectacle in exactly the same way Beijing did. Exactly the same. So here's how it might run. Australia decides to mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II with a mass march in, say, Sydney. Its official name is to be commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the victory of Australian people's resistance against Japanese aggression and world anti-fascist war. The march is going to run down George Street, and Town Hall will be the focal point, where large temporary stands will be built for spectators. As the coalition is in power, they will invite the only spectators allowed to attend, and the only people to get a pass, other than party loyalists, will be war veterans. 2 weeks before the main parade, there'll have to be a practice run through the city. On Saturday night from around 10 p.m, George Street will be closed off to the public and reopened the next morning. When the actual event comes, on a Thursday 2 weeks later, this will involve a major shutdown of the city. Every business, every office along George Street, from Central Station to Circular Quay, will have to be closed from Wednesday to Saturday. People who live along the parade route will not be allowed to look out their windows on parade day, and they definitely cannot step out onto a balcony. On parade eve, if they leave home, they'll be locked out of the area for around 12 hours. All roads leading up to George Street for at least one block and sometimes two blocks back will also be cordoned off. Only residents will be allowed into these areas during the shutdown period, and they will also not be allowed to leave. All businesses there will also be closed down for 3 days. On parade day, nobody without a special pass will be allowed within one block of George Street. So that means only Liberal and National Party loyalists, the police, the military, and some veterans. After it takes off, the march will be eye candy for those with a military nationalist bent, with cameras galore from every angle. There will be a few veterans in the stands at Town Hall, but the amazing, tightly drilled formations will be the new breed. Young troops with high-tech weapons, attack helicopters, jets flying overhead, as well as nuclear-capable missile launchers cruising past the old Lowe's building where my grandmother used to work. Ordinary people will be expected to watch it on television. Some other world leaders will come. They might be from, say, New Zealand, the Cook Islands, Israel and Papua New Guinea, and they'll bring some of their marching soldiers to participate. Other heads of state will stay well away. Just before the march, Prime Minister Tony Abbott will announce in his speech a modest reduction in Australian troop numbers as our country's contribution to global peace. And at the end, we'll release thousands of white doves into the sky above the city. It's hard to know what Australians would make of this, but I just can't imagine they'd cop it. In China, on the other hand, people are simply used to mass events being carried out in this way. When Beijing got the Winter Olympics and the envelope was opened up on a big screen in front of the Bird's Nest Stadium, the crowd was made up of invited guests only. Nothing can be left to chance here, and the authorities simply don't want to risk the possibility that something might go wrong. This is Stephen McDonnell in Beijing.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Now, the Kingdom of Bhutan is one of the world's most secretive nations. It's a nation that is not really welcoming to tourists. In fact, if you do plan to go there to visit, you have to spend so many US dollars a day just to actually get a visa. And this is strictly because they want to leave the environment peaceful and calm and untouched. Now, the culture in Bhutan is also an interesting one because it's a culture that's more oral than written. Now, government media recently in Bhutan is relatively new compared to other nations in the region. So what is it like starting up a newspaper in the country? Richard Ady speaks to Bunty Averson. She's a journalist and writer and lecturer in journalism at the University of Sydney.
The time that they decided to launch newspapers was around the same time that newspapers were being so challenged everywhere else in the world. So it was a big call for a couple of reasons, and it's had mixed success.
Well, that's it. You said there was one newspaper run by the government. Nobody read it. So there's yes. No culture of reading newspapers.
No, there's no culture of reading. It's an oral culture.
No culture of reading at all.
No culture of reading at all. That's changing slowly, but culturally, no. It's an oral culture where they had, there's something like 23 different languages, not dialects, but languages, and all of them are oral. with no written form. And then the king decided about 30 years ago that they needed to be able to create a written form for one of these languages as part of this moving into the modern world. So while there was, the monasteries had prayer books and they had writing and reading, the mainstream people didn't write things down and they didn't read.
So in fact, isn't there a saying that if you want to keep a secret in Bhutan, write it in a book?
That's right, because no one will read it.
Okay, I can see what possessed you then.
It was a challenge, unlike any other.
Well, let's get a sense of the paper itself, so the office and the staff. Given that there's no real tradition of reading newspapers, how much training did the people who were actually putting the paper out have?
Well, they didn't have any training. Well, it varied. Some of them had gone to India and had worked on newspapers there or been trained. The newspaper that existed, the government one, had evolved over time. And the story of the government newspaper was quite an interesting one. The man who launched it, Kinley Dorji, came to Australia to learn to be a journalist. And he was the country's first journalist. And that was about 25, 30 years ago. And he was in the same year as Andrew Denton and Amanda Keller at Bathurst. And he was sent by the king at the time to go and learn to be a journalist, come back and start or move our government gazette towards being a newspaper. So that government gazette, Kunsul newspaper, was started by the country's first journalist that was trained in Australia. And then he trained people under him that worked on that newspaper. So there was, when I say that there was no tradition of newspapers, not amongst the mainstream, certainly the educated government people and the royal family read the newspaper, but the majority of people didn't. And so when the family that I knew decided they wanted to start a newspaper, there weren't any journalists to kind of, you know, poach or to, and they couldn't bring people in from outside.
How did they recruit?
Well, the recruiting was a lot of fun. They invited university graduates to come and explain what they would do on the newspaper. And the ones that wrote an essay in English that made the most sense about what a newspaper could be got the job. The sense of enthusiasm and this is a brave new world was brilliant.
And I suppose the other thing is that you don't know what you can't do. You're not restricted by the kind of the norms of doing a newspaper or the orthodoxies of how you do journalism.
That's right. Absolutely.
And that can be positive.
And they came up with such creative ways to do things. For example, there was no businesses to go and say buy space to sell your product. They just didn't have that kind of marketing advertising culture. So what they did is they went to Wikipedia and downloaded a list of days. You know, like there's International Tuberculosis Day, International Handwashing Day, International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Yes.
They downloaded that list, highlighted all the ones that they thought were relevant, and then went to various NGOs and government departments to get them to sponsor information pullouts that week. So it wasn't advertising as we would recognise it. It was more public service pullouts that matched these international days.
All right, so how did it fit into this newly evolving media landscape? Because you've already mentioned there was the government paper, and I think there was another independent starting around the same time.
Yes, two of them launched at the same time, Bhutan Times and Bhutan Observer. Well, they were greeted with a lot of enthusiasm, and it appeared to a lot of the educated class that this was a good thing to do to launch newspapers. There are currently, or last time I looked, there was a dozen newspapers. All of them are failing. There still isn't advertising. There still isn't much of a newspaper culture.
What is in them? If I pick up one of these papers, if I pick up the paper you worked at, what am I going to read about, assuming I can read that language?
You'll read very much what's going on with the Bhutanese government, with what's happening in the main city of Thimphu. It's very local news and it's things about the roads, what the farmers are doing, the price of potatoes. Very domestic news.
It's a very agricultural country, isn't it? So
yes.
You're going to, I imagine, there's going to be a lot about agriculture.
Yes. And there's also a lot about the royal family.
I guess the royal family's at the top of the hierarchy. Is there a tradition in which you can ask hard questions of people who are kind of not at your level?
It's a very hierarchical structure socially. So that has been a challenge for them with this new media landscape, or now having journalists asking questions, because traditionally you wouldn't. Traditionally you wouldn't ask questions of a very important person or somebody who was part of the senior government or certainly the royals. You just wouldn't question them. But that's being turned on its head now that they are a democracy and now that there is an active media.
And so how do the people who are not used to being asked questions, who've spent perhaps decades not being asked questions, when somebody rolls up and asks them a question?
It's been very challenging. So some of the government ministers have refused to respond. They're in a state of everybody's learning their roles. So the journalists are learning to ask the hard questions and the ministers are learning to be accountable. And it's a bit of a dance and it's a bit of learning on both sides and in constant negotiation.
I can't ask about Bhutan without thinking of this gross national happiness, because that is probably the thing Bhutan's best known for, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it real?
Look, I spent a lot of time trying to get my head around gross national happiness. This is something that comes up in conversation pretty much every part of the day.
Really?
It is so much part of their public discussion about, yes.
So at news meetings, when you're trying to work out what you're covering, it's going to come up?
Yes, repeatedly. It is how they frame all of the what they consider to be progress within their country.
You tell a story, actually, in your book about a reporter who actually, trailing along these sorts of public meetings where everyone says how full of gross national happiness they are, he actually tests that and finds it's not that simple.
Yes. He went along because they once a year they will go right across the country and interview every single inhabitant to ask them about their level of happiness and how they're going.
And people say they're fantastically happy, don't they?
People are confronted with these important people from the capital, Thimphu. They're visiting them. They're so overwhelmed and impressed that these people have come, and they say yes to anything that they're asked. And this reporter from the Bhutan Observer saw this going on, and because he was also from a poor village, he could see exactly what was going on. So after these important men with their ledgers left, he asked the local farmers, and are you happy? And they said, well, of course not. We haven't got enough food to eat. And he was able to unpack, using his skills as a journalist and using his voice as a journalist and his platform, he was able to bring that to the fore in a way that their institutionalised structures weren't.
No, indeed. How did the story go down, though?
Beautifully. It's what they wanted. It's part of this kind of change and dynamism even the Gross National Happiness Commission themselves, who were conducting the survey, were happy that it came out. That's what they're trying to, you know, dismantle and discover.
You mentioned earlier that there's now something like 12 newspapers and they're all sort of struggling.
Yes.
What about, and also that the country is very, it's a spoken culture. Where does that leave social media, something like Facebook?
Yes. Well, this is what has been such an extraordinary change for them. So while newspapers arrived and were struggling, at the same time digital media arrived, mobile phones were phenomenally successful. There's something like 93% of households have a mobile phone.
Wow.
And they use them to do all sorts of things. They use them to stream radio. So you've got yak farmers in remote mountain areas who are completely up to date with what's happening in politics and streaming parliament live on their mobile phones. They're a terribly politically engaged culture. But then they're also using Facebook. Facebook has been phenomenal. It's created this space where they now have all that public discussion that the king wanted to happen in the newspapers, but it just being an oral culture in the newspapers weren't so successful. Modern media, digital media, has created this space for all of that. So the Facebook pages they use them for political activism, for culture. They use it like a virtual town square. Facebook has been, somehow it has absolutely culturally been appropriate for them. They love it.
So this change that the king instigated, it's working. And what it's doing, though, is exposing problems of if you don't have enough to eat, there's a lot of poverty in a country like Bhutan. It's not the Shangri-La that it's too often easy to think of, a country which celebrates gross national happiness. These changes beginning with newspapers, but also with mobiles and social media, they're actually making a difference.
Yes. What I found so interesting going back there again and again is that before newspapers arrived, before television arrived, in particular television, there was a lot of talk in the West and concern that it would ruin Bhutan, all this outside influence. But actually what the Bhutanese are doing with all these modern media is they're using it to talk amongst themselves, and they're using it to reflect their own culture to each other. And before mobile phones and things, if you're talking about remote farmers, they would see other farmers once a year at the annual Seshu, the festival. Now they have a media space where they find about history, about their leaders, about their culture. So it's created a really vibrant space where they're talking and they're animated and they're criticising and showcasing all things that are important to them.
That was Bunty Averson, a journalist and writer and lecturer at the University of Sydney in Australia, speaking there with Richard Aidy. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Just a quick program note, we're going to have a couple of special programs coming up in October. On October the 3rd and October the 10th, we'll have two special archive editions of Focus Asia Pacific. That's for the weekly edition of the program. The daily, the three times daily, I should say, 15-minute edition of the program will be going ahead as scheduled. If you wish to contact us and let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, hoping to see you all again very soon. Until next time, so long and take care.